before we get started, a public service announcement. In a word, Zicam. It's a cold remedy that, in my experience, is really a breakthrough. It's zinc, some kind of zinc compound. I take it in lozenges. Yesterday, I had a full onset of cold. I was blowing my nose through much of the day, but I had caught it early, right? The very first sign, I started taking this Zicam, and I think without it, I wouldn't be here giving Taisho this morning. It really has it's remarkably effective, and enough other people here find it also so that we stock it at Sesshin to hand out to people who are coming down with a cold. Like every cold remedy, it seems you need to catch it early, pounce right on it as soon as you start to notice it. But you may have to put up with some lingering effects of it this morning from me. I'm going to talk about fear and anxiety. Actually, this doesn't have anything to do with the approach of Halloween. For a long time, I've come to understand that an awful lot of people in the Sangha and outside the Sangha are afflicted by fear and anxiety. And it's time to air what I've learned about it and what I've read about it and Buddhist perspective on it, and also the just the biological perspective on it, evolutionary perspective on it. First, I started this with preparing this by looking up in the dictionary these two words, fear and anxiety, because I've never been quite clear about the difference between them. I'll just read both of these. Fear: a feeling of anxiety and agitation caused by the presence or nearness of danger. Danger, evil, pain, etc. So the caused by the presence or nearness. And then anxiety, a state of being uneasy, apprehensive, or worried about what may happen. Concern about a possible future event. So, different people in different fields of work may define these differently, but let's just go with sort of a general sense of fear as being more of an immediate possible threat. That has some basis in reality and more of a body. And then anxiety is something additional. I think of the Buddhist term putting suffering on top of suffering. It's more of a secondary thing that we as human beings alone seem to be afflicted with. It may be that we're the only creature that has anxiety about what may happen or a possible future event, whereas probably any creature knows fear. It's a survival instinct. I'm going to just pluck out a couple paragraphs from an article on that came out after September 11th, the disaster with the World Trade Center. In Tricycle Magazine, they had a series of articles about fear, and this one, there's this four or five of them, very short, and the first one is by a Wes Nisker, who is a Zen teacher on the West Coast. Fear is perfectly natural, with its roots lying deep in the survival instinct. All living beings, from the simplest amoeba to some of the most realized beings on the planet, will have some form of aversive reaction to external threats. He then relates the story of having been on a small plane with the Dalai Lama, flying from Dharamsala, that's where the Dalai Lama's palace is, from Dharamsala to New Delhi, a route where the updrafts from the Himalayan foothills can be vicious. And he says in his autobiography, His Holiness talks about his fear of flying, and every time I glanced back at him on this particular flight, he was visibly anxious, staring intently out of the window while fingering his mala, that's the beads, fingering his mala and silently reciting a mantra. So this hopefully will be not too shocking to people who naively imagine that a lifetime of Dharma practice could free you from basic evolutionary instincts. So let's begin this by acknowledging that these sensations of fear are biologically programmed. We're wired to feel fear at times. The Buddha called all such organic reactions underlying tendencies. And according to one text, he said the way to work with them is to realize this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. This is a little bit touchy because I would say that the most important thing is not to separate yourself from the fear, but I think this is not separating in the same way. You're facing it. You're not in denial. You're not suppressing it. You're looking at it, and you're recognizing that this is a passing state. It's not, to use the old phrase from Buddhism, host and guest, that these fear states are not the host. They're the guest. And guests go just as they come. So they're not who we really are. They're just a mind-body state that has formed out of causes and conditions beyond our control and that will pass. We don't have to identify it. We don't want to identify with it. And yet we don't want to separate ourselves from it either. This is tricky stuff. And then this Wes Nisker says that he uses when he feels fear, and this would be for any emotion. We're just going to focus on fear, but it works for sadness or anger also. He says, what has become almost a mantra for me, which he uses, is it's perfectly natural. It's pretty good device when you're feeling a strong emotion, anger, fear, sadness. It's perfectly natural. He says another phrase that I use is "I'm only human," and then he says some people prefer "I'm perfectly human." It's a good one. Perfectly human. Our humanity, with our biological wiring, in that is our perfection in its own way. That is our true nature manifesting itself through our human body-mind. He says, in employing these devices. He says, often the physical sensations will remain, or they may begin to move and change, but whatever they do, my sense of self is no longer so tightly contracted around them. Recognizing that difficult emotions are common to all humans also seems to arouse immediate feelings of empathy with others. We share our emotions. They are part of our collective karma, the human condition. People who imagine that they have no fear or anxiety are simply out of touch with themselves. I used to think that when I was much younger, until I went skydiving. In college, I had always wanted to do this, and so I went and took the 5 hours of training and then went up, and as we were climbing in this little Cessna, I was terrified, absolutely terrified. But even greater than my terror was my pride, so I was determined not to, I had to jump. Of course, I could have stayed in the plane and come down, but then how could I put my certificate on the wall that they gave us? So I was the first to go. There were two of us to jump, and I climbed out of the open kind of door there, doorway of this thing, and onto the tire, as we were instructed, and with my hands on the wing of the plane, looking down. Looking down at these little corn checks of field below me, and just froze. And the deal is, they want to time it so that when you go down, you're not going to land in the next county. So they tell you ahead of time, okay, when we say jump. So I'm there like frozen, standing on this tire. They were nice enough to lock the tire so it wasn't spinning. And I was relieved at that, at least. And then the pilot at one point just yells out of the plane, "Go!" And I pretended I didn't hear him. And then the second time he said, "Go," and then you push off backwards. And there's a in Michigan at the time, I hope still is true, you had to have on your first jump, you had to have a static line, which means a cord that is attached to the plane, and then when you get down about 20 feet down, it automatically opens your chute, so you don't have to worry about blacking out or something. When I came down, I realized I will never do this again. This is the stupidest thing. My whole life held by a thread, literally. If anything had malfunctioned, what a waste for a thrill to be able to say from then on that I did this thing. It was quite an epiphany for me to see how silly that was. Not that it's somehow bad or wrong. Some people eat the stuff up and they do hundreds of jumps. And some of those very people sometimes die because something went wrong. One little story more about this and I'll get off it, but during our that classroom training, they took us into the hangar and they showed how the chutes were folded. And they took us to one of these master parachute folders, and he was working very slowly, deliberately around this gigantic table. And as we came in, our little group came in, we watched him fold one corner up and then very methodically go around and fold another corner up and so forth. And then they explained that their form of quality control was that when they would go into randomly, a supervisor would go in and go to the pile, the stack of folded chutes, and just pull one out from the middle of the chute, middle of the pile, and give it to the folder, the chute folder, and say, "Go jump with this." Yeah. It was reassuring. Some people, I think that we have their individual differences in our optimal level of anxiety or fear. We know the popularity of horror movies and the whole Halloween thing. That it's not that we. It's like stress. It's not that the less stress the better. That we each of us has a certain level of stress, and I would say, I suppose the same is true of anxiety or fear. A certain level that is just right for us, where it makes us feel alive. It prevents boredom. And there are people who are just risk takers. They have a higher level of fear that makes them feel alive, and other people much lower than that. And I think some of these things we're just that's our nature, our individual nature, and then our job is to work with that. I think these things are often lifelong conditions. They're just people who are more anxious. Luckily, we now live in a kind of a golden age of pharmaceutical treatments where people can take drugs that enable them to go to work or to get on a plane or do other things. There's a paragraph I pulled out of a book called How God Changes Your Brain, Breakthrough Findings from a Leading Neuroscientist. And this is by Andrew Newberg, MD. This is a paragraph. We all harbor a pack of neurological wolves in our brain. The old ones reside in the limbic system, and they are filled with aggression and fear. They're fast, efficient, and potentially deadly, and they've been running the show for 150 million years. Mm-hmm. The younger ones reside in our frontal lobes and anterior cingulate, where empathy, reason, logic, and compassion reside. These pups are playful and imaginative, but they are also neurologically vulnerable and slow when compared to the activity in the emotional parts of the brain. So this is what we're up against, our natural biological tendencies, our wiring. And it becomes a question of practical, using our attention to feed the rational, empathic, compassionate aspects of our wiring, and not the other. One of the things that inspired this Taisho was just seeing in the news. I watch and hear more news than I would want to admit, but what's fascinating is that even in any kind of news is truth. There's the Dharma in everything. For example, Putin. Putin's swaggering first in the Ukraine and now in Syria. I read an article about that traces back his rough tendencies to fear that developed when there was a particular incident when he was, I think, in his 30s, where he was in charge of some KGB station in eastern Germany. I think he's fluent in German. And it was that when the wall had come down or was about to come down, and the East Germans were feeling that they had gained the upper hand. And so he came out and faced a big crowd of people who wanted to storm into his KGB station. And what it reported was that this had a lasting effect on him, that the specter of mass protest, of mob rule, this is the fear that lies at the heart of his belief in the primacy of state authority, both in Russia itself and abroad. You see how we can be formed, these things, aside from our wiring, our biological wiring, an event can dispose us to react out of this limbic system rather than our better nature. And so we see this play out now on the world stage. His effort to compensate for his fear by his fear also of Russia being encircled by hostile forces, and then as a result now we have this guy to try to manage. Guns. What would prompt one to have guns in your house other than fear? Target shooting. How common is that? How often is that the reason? I think in many cases it's just kind of an abstract fear of the other. Fear of the other. Which, by the way, I would venture to say may often be a projection of one's own hostility. These people who are arming themselves with guns and are always braying about how Obama's going to take their guns from them have a lot of unresolved hostility in themselves that they just project onto others, and imagine that they're facing a hostile world for which they have to be ready with their guns. That also can be that this need to have guns is can be a fear of being weak, also compensatory. See the incidents in the news of these confrontations between police and citizens, most recently police and African Americans, in addition to wincing at the brutality of many of these cases of the police and their misuse of their power, I also have to acknowledge that the police, it seems, are sometimes acting out of fear for their lives. Whether that's rational is another matter. But let us acknowledge that that these are cases where, their limbic system is short-circuiting their better judgment. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't fire them or prosecute police who do these things, but But we also can try to understand what's behind that. Put yourself in the position of a cop who is dealing with these one situation or another and reacts. If we look at our own tendencies, our own reactive tendencies, if we face the fact that we have blown it in the past, not with guns maybe, but with our own reacting out of fear and anxiety in our interpersonal relationships, well, imagine being on the front lines here, out in the street, where one misjudgment and you can be killed yourself. I'm not taking the side of the police. I'm trying to understand, trying to understand what goes on here in these situations. Remember the very celebrated case of George Zimmerman killing Trayvon Martin, and how it came down to that struggle on the ground where Trayvon Martin ended up being killed. If a cop says, "I feared for my life," how, in some cases, that would be obviously just an excuse, but in other cases, how do we know? How can we say they weren't fearing for their lives? And this is where the training of police is so important, not to mention doing something about this insanity with guns being so available to anyone, whether you're mentally deranged or not. I jotted down some other things here. Fear of fear of failure. I suspect this is something that handicaps people in Sesshin when they feel very motivated to break through their koan or come to awakening. And not everyone at all, but some people probably, the fear of not doing it, fear of, quote, failing, and that's, you have to put quotes around it, because what is that, what failure is there in making your best effort and falling short of what you had hoped to do? It's not, I don't see that as failure. But this fear of failure can work for us. It can motivate, it can be a huge spur to greater effort. I've read that a huge motivator in East Asia, generally China, Japan, Korea, is fear of bringing shame to your family or your ancestors or others. And this, they say, is a great, very powerful motivator for the great achievements that Asians have seen in their lives, in their countries. So it's not fear itself that we somehow could see as bad. It's how we work with the fear, how we manage it. Fear of change. This is arguably the greatest, one of the greatest of human fears, is fear of change. And you see this among those who are most strongly conservative. They want to conserve what has been, conserve the tradition, which is not misguided, unless it change is called for, of course. It depends on the circumstances. But fear of change, this is why people, when they start a meditation practice, may provoke, inadvertently provoke fear in people close to them, because their family, their partner, may worry that the meditation will change their partner. Even if they fight all the time with their partner, still the fear of what could be or what might be or what the fear of some unknown change can trump the problems you may have in a relationship. Look at the Muslim fundamentalists, the jihadists, the fanatics. What's underneath that? Fear. It really helps us in dealing with difficult people if we can look beneath the surface and see that there must be some kind of fear under all hostility. Anyway, that's what I, whether that's true or not, I think it really works when dealing with hostile, angry people. There's got to be fear under there. It doesn't mean that we have to enjoy those people or put up with them even, but it can neutralize our reactive tendencies if we can have enough space in the mind to take a breath and realize that they're acting out of fear. Look for it. Where might it be with people you fight with? What is their fear? Find it yourself. Imagine it. It's got to be there. Our deepest disposition is to want to join with others, to embrace others, to find commonality with others. And if we're doing the opposite, then there's something underneath that, some kind of fear. In Zen practice, we see people, some people more than others, who have fear of pain. This can be for a beginner. This can operate when they're just starting off and they're coming to their first sitting, where they might then hesitate because of fear of physical pain, of not moving. It's really unnecessary. You know, we don't require that people sit in any painful posture. You want to start on your own at home, maybe experimenting with two or three postures, and find out whether you can hold a posture for 35 minutes without moving, or on Tuesday nights just 25 minutes, and yet that can be a hurdle for some people, and not to mention for Sashin. How many people know that their practice can be greatly advanced by going to Sashin, but who hold back out of fear of what could happen? You know, there was a time here when, before we had Chapin Mill and we were all crammed in this zendo, where the rarest cases would someone be allowed to sit in a chair. Now at Chapin Mill, with this bad cavernous zendo, we have room for chairs, and people who find that it's too much to sit on the mat in any posture can always, in the next round, go to a chair. I'm starting to fret that people are too easily now. It's the pendulum has swung the other way, and maybe I don't know. Maybe some people are too easily giving up and bailing to a chair when they could just persevere through the pain and get on the other side of it and have experienced a great way of converting pain into something else. More on that later. Pain of boredom. Fear of boredom. This came to me when recently someone gave me an article. Maybe it's from the New York Times. There's no identification here, but the article is about a study showing that most men, this is the title, most men would rather shock themselves than be alone with their thoughts. think the larger issue here is fear of being alone. That's a big one that torments some people more than others. Pascal, the French philosopher, said, all the unhappiness of men arises from the fact that they cannot sit quietly alone in their own room. And this is probably something else that some people makes them not stick with Zen practice, is just being alone with their thoughts. This study, this is from an article this summer, from published in Science magazine, that when they had people just sit and do nothing but think, they found that about a quarter of women and two-thirds of men chose electric shocks over their own company. Just a couple things here. Desperate for distractions. Now this, if you haven't seen this operating in your own sitting, where you're desperate for something to take you away from the moment, then I don't know how long you've been sitting, but that is a pretty common thing at first, before you learn how to practice. So 12 of 18 men preferred shocking themselves, electric shocks, than just being alone with their thoughts. Fewer women, and the authors speculate that the fact that more men were willing to shock themselves, maybe because men tend to be more sensation seeking than women, like men who jump out of planes. After I hit the ground, and that skydiving thing, I realized, well, long after, it was maybe after I started going to Sesshin, I looked back on it, and I came to the conclusion that what I was doing was facing my fear of death in a sort of silly way, that I was trying to conquer my fear of death by going up in that plane. Of course, at the time, as my psychologist wife once said, I wouldn't have known a feeling if I'd found it in my soup. I didn't know how frightened I was of death until I went up. We were climbing into the clouds. But I think this also may operate somewhat in the attraction of horror movies and in Halloween, all kinds of Halloween stuff. But again, some people just enjoying the excitement. One woman's anxiety is another woman's excitement. That's something else I learned from my wife, that whereas I had never been much aware of anxiety in myself, that you can transmute anxiety into excitement. And some lucky people, fortunate people, experience excitement where others might experience anxiety. I know when I wake up on a Sunday morning when I'm to give Taisho and I have no topic in mind, what I experience as excitement is probably some form of anxiety, but it can be galvanizing when you use anxiety that way. Same with when I used to go to, in the days leading up to Sesshin, I felt a real dread I started to chart it the Tuesday before the Sesshin started, and then that dread would convert into excitement. I suppose this is what career soldiers and athletes going into a high-stakes match or game, of course they have some anxiety, fear of losing, but they've learned to manage that and to convert it into great physical effort. The ultimate fear, surely, is the fear of death. Although they've done studies about fears and have found, this slays me, that the fear of death is the number two fear, statistically. The number one is fear of public speaking. Has anyone ever felt that? but look at it. Look at what is a fear of public speaking. It's somehow failing of seeing your self-image, your ego, take a beating. And what is fear of death but fear of disappearing? None of us knows what death is experientially. And I have no doubt in my mind that the fear of death, really, underneath that, is a fear of not being. And this is why, when we're getting especially deep into our concentration and thoughts have become few, we're approaching a kind of a real emptiness of mind, that sometimes fear, even terror, can rise up, because the self is nothing more than a cluster of memories and thoughts and associations and images of ourselves. It's all that mental stuff. That's what we call the self. And when that is disappearing, then we're facing the primal fear, which is fear of not being, which is fear of death. And if we can press on into that fear and not turn back, then we can come out the other side. We come to see that there's nothing there. We're fine. We're not going to, as Roshi Kaplow once said to me in Doksan, you don't worry, you're not going to fall out of the universe. It's a good reminder. These things are irrational, of course, but the fact that they're irrational doesn't mean they're not powerful, powerful fears or anxieties. In a book by Edward Kanza, he's a Buddhist scholar and author, he describes this kind of fear, and I remember this anxiety, and I wonder how many other people. This is the anxiety of being human. And this is what he said: according to the views elaborated by Scheller, Freud, Heidegger, and Jaspers, there is in the core of our being a basic anxiety, a little empty hole from which all other forms of anxiety and unease draw their strength. In its pure form, this anxiety is experienced only by people with an introspective and philosophical turn of mind, and even then, only rarely. If one has never felt it oneself, no amount of explanation will convince. If one has felt it, one will never forget, however much one may try. It may come upon you when you have been asleep, withdrawn from the world. You wake up in the middle of the night and feel a kind of astonishment at being there, which then gives way to a fear and horror at the mere fact of being there. It is then that you catch yourself by yourself, just for a moment, against the background of a kind of nothingness all around you, and with a gnawing sense of your powerlessness, your utter helplessness in the face of this astonishing fact that you are there at all. Usually we avoid this experience as much as we possibly can because it is so shattering and painful. Usually I am very careful not to have myself by myself, but the I plus all sorts of other experiences. Again, what Pascal said about being in a room alone. People who are busy all the time, who must always think of something, who must always be doing something, are incessantly running away from this experience of the basic or original anxiety. What we usually do is to lean and to rely on something else than this empty center of ourselves. The Buddhist contention is that we will never be at ease before we have overcome this basic anxiety, and that we can do that only by relying on nothing at all. Nothing at all. That's where our practice of breath or koan is leading us into this realm of an empty mind, of nothing at all to grasp at. And in that is our salvation. So fear of the unknown, that ranks right up there with fear of change. I guess it's probably sort of the same thing. Because if we don't know what the change will be, that's fear of the unknown. Fear of losing control. And then all of the many, many more specific kinds of phobias and other fears. I came across this book years ago. It's a pop-up book of phobias. And I left it out in the link. If you have an idle moment, check it out. It's only about a dozen phobias there, and it's really great work of art to show these. All right. So what to do when you're feeling fear or anxiety? Number one, and I'd say number one, number two, and number three is to notice it. Be aware of it. Don't try to block it out of your, don't try to deny it, but be aware of it. How will you be aware? How are you going to be aware of fear or anxiety? Well, the most simple, one simple way is to notice the bodily signs of it. Notice if your palms are getting wet. Notice if there's constriction in your throat. Notice if your heart is racing. Notice if you're getting wet under the armpits. These are important. These are things that points of awareness, because we can't do anything about fear. It's the same with anger or sadness. We have to be able to rely on physiological signs. So then once we've become aware, this is fear, this is anxiety, then what? Above all, not to separate oneself from the fear or anxiety. That is, by acknowledging it, but also not dwelling on it, not dwelling in thoughts of whatever the fearful thoughts are or the anxious thoughts. So neither separating oneself nor dwelling on it. And that is how we come to transcend it. We learn this by, in our sitting, when we can't move, by just facing our pain. What do? You don't pretend it's not there. You notice it. You're aware of it. But you don't make the mistake of dwelling in thoughts about it. That just is a sure way to sustain the pain. So what do? Well, when you're sitting, you become one with the pain. How do you do that? Well, by neither suppressing it nor clinging to thoughts about it, you just go into the breath or the koan. That's, and then if you stick with that, if you really commit to not thinking about the pain, but pouring your whole mind into the practice you're working on, then you can be astonished to find yourself coming out the other side of it where it may still be there a bit, the physical pain, or let's bring it out of the zendo, whatever the fear is, it may still be there sort of on the margins of your awareness, but it's not a problem. Your relationship to the fear has changed. It's there, but it's not such a big deal. It's not such a big problem. It helps to also always, in any kind of state, to remind yourself that it'll pass. Because it will. With a sitting, when you stand up, it'll be gone. And you can use your breath to breathe into the pain or the fear. Here I've slid into talking about pain, but into the fear. Breathing into the fear. Knowing it as it is. That's how we come to know it as it is, which is just a movement of emotional energy. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.